From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, live from Radio Row at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, where tonight President Obama takes the stage to argue for a Hillary Clinton presidency. Last night, the first Clinton to occupy the White House, Bill, made his case with stories about his life with Hillary, including how he tried three times to get her to marry him and chatted her up while both were in line to register for law school classes.
And I thought I was doing pretty well. Till we got to the front of the line and the registrar looked up and said, Bill, what are you doing here? You registered this morning. I turned red and she laughed, that big laugh of hers. And I thought, well, heck, since my cover's been blown, I just went ahead and asked her to take a walk down to the art museum. We've been walking and talking and laughing together ever since.
But it's a different Democratic Party now, and several hundred Bernie Sanders delegates either walked out in protest over Hillary Clinton's nomination or they were too young to remember comeback kid Bill Clinton. Here now, political analyst Jamal Simmons joins us. He's also a Democratic strategist. And Jamal, what about that point? We were struck that this is an older Bill Clinton.
This is an older Bill Clinton, and one may wonder why, in a room full of Democrats, Bill Clinton would find it, or the convention would find it necessary to go through Hillary Clinton's life story. Well, the reality is what you just said. There are a lot of people in that room who are too young to remember the Bill Clinton era. And there are some people who may remember the Bill Clinton era, but their first memories of it aren't that great. So if you're pretty young and the first thing you remember is impeachment, then you never had the joy of Rock the Vote and the parties and the 1992 campaign with people crying. Like, whenever I tell somebody who's, you know, in their 30s or under that about how Bill Clinton used to have people crying when he would get off of an airplane and walk out onto a stage, they can't possibly believe it, that he was the Barack Obama of his era.
Well, and also many people would have no clue. I mean, we think, oh, there's been books written, but no clue about Hillary Clinton's many accomplishments, say what you will, but including, you know, helping write disabilities acts because she went to Boston even before they married to find out why kids weren't going to school, and that story of finding a child in a wheelchair on her porch who could not go to school because she was in a wheelchair.
And even a lot of people who do know those stories, they don't remember them, right? It's been so long ago since maybe you heard them. And so it's a good chance to get people focused on who Hillary Clinton is, what she's done, and then tie all those threads about her life together into a story that the Democrats can then bring everybody in and go forward.
Well, and to try to undo the story that, as you said, many have heard, here's Bill Clinton last night referring to Republicans and their dislike of Hillary Clinton.
Well, if you win elections on the theory that government is always bad and will mess up a two-car parade, a real changemaker represents a real threat. So, your only option is to create a cartoon.
Which is what he says the Republicans have done. But, you know, here's some anecdotal, you know, just walking around the hall, walking around today, asking people what they thought.
Sure.
First of all, there are women that I've spoken to who said, I wish he'd gone there. I wish he kind of sort of went there.
Yeah.
You mentioned the impeachment. He kind of sort of went there and said, we've had some tough times and she stuck with me. She'll stick with you. Some people wish he'd said, you know what? I didn't deserve her standing by me during the time of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. You're nodding.
Yes, he should have acknowledged it, I think, because everybody in the room was thinking it. And I imagine a lot of people at home were wondering how he would do it. And what he said was, he did a story about 1997, and then he said, well, fast forward to 1999, and she did something else that was great. Well, there's a lot that happened between 1997 and 1999, and it's one of the things that actually grates against her. I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I met a woman who really should be a Hillary Clinton voter. This was in 2007, 2008. And the thing that she had against it was that she just didn't understand how she managed to work her way through staying with him after being so publicly embarrassed.
Yeah.
And I think there's some residue there that really needs to be dealt with.
Might be addressed. Well, I just want to bring up something else that came up today. The two email scandals. Donald Trump in a news conference today was talking about the suspected Russian hacking of DNC emails the FBI is investigating. And Hillary Clinton's other email problems, the ones her attorneys deleted from her private server when she was Secretary of State. Here he is.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
How do the Democrats come back at Donald Trump and his criticism of the Clintons and the what the Russians revealed.
Look, this Russian story is not good for Donald Trump, and maybe he's trying to find a way to take a tack on it.
Because why? Explain why.
Well, I think maybe he's trying to find a way to take a tack on it that will make people be focused on the Clintons and not focus on the fact that he's been coming up with policies that benefit Vladimir Putin. And now we know that the Russians are the ones who hacked the DNC servers, and they released that. So why would they release that now? Maybe it's to hurt Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. So Trump is coming up with policies that help Putin. The Russians are doing things that help Clinton. It just looks a little smarmy.
Well, President Obama did say in an interview released today that the FBI had previously told the White House and the DNC that Russia was trying to influence the election. And now, of course, the Democrats are saying influence it in favor of Donald Trump. And you're saying, why would
you want to know for sure, we can't testify to what Putin is doing, but we can testify that Trump's position on NATO and Trump's position on the EU and Brexit are only benefit Vladimir Putin. So we know how Trump helps Russians. The question is, are the Russians trying to help Trump?
That's here now political analyst Jamal Simmons, also a Democratic strategist, sending his thoughts to the Democrats about what they should be saying about Donald Trump's comments. Jamal, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
Turning now to Baltimore, where today the Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced that prosecutors are dropping remaining charges against police officers facing trial in connection with the death of Freddie Gray. He's the 25-year-old black man who died while in police custody. Three Baltimore officers have already been acquitted and three others were facing trial. Officer Garrett Miller's trial was supposed to begin today when prosecutors made their announcement. A strict gag order on people associated with the trials has also been lifted, which is why today marked the first time that Marilyn Mosby has spoken publicly about the case in months. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has been reporting on the case, and she joins us now. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there.
So first of all, tell us more about what Mosby said about why prosecutors are dropping the remaining charges.
Well, she was very clear that she stands by her contention that the officer's actions did amount to a crime. She said to a crowd in Freddie Gray's neighborhood, "We don't believe Freddie Gray killed himself." But she said, look, it's been clear. The judge has issued three verdicts in his acquittals, and he has explained, laid out very clearly, he does not agree with that and that does not see evidence of criminal action.
I see that Mosby also, in this press conference today, did she go so far as accusing individual officers in the Baltimore Police Department of making the state's case more difficult?
She did. She didn't name names, but there have been fireworks actually in the courtroom that have erupted between a prosecutor in the case and one of the lead police investigators. And basically, Mosby said that police officers were making up notes after the fact, and that she pointed to texts back and forth saying that there was this inherent bias in the police department, that they didn't agree with the prosecution, and that they were trying to thwart it, basically. She called out an intrinsic bias and says this is what happens when police investigate themselves, and called for reforms to hold police departments more accountable. Mm-hmm. Stunning charges, and we're waiting to see what the police department will say about that.
Interesting. Now, Marilyn Mosby herself has been under some pressure to resign or even admit error in bringing the charges in the first place. Do you think that today's announcement will relax some of those pressures?
Well, she was clearly trying to show people, no, she didn't make a mistake and it wasn't rushed and so forth. But obviously, a lot of people have felt from the beginning that the charges came out so quickly. They weren't well researched and thought out and never should have been pursued. I mean, legal analysts still say, you know, they never saw evidence of criminal intent and it was the state's burden to prove this. At the same time, you know, I spoke with a lawyer who's been watching this from the beginning and he says, you know, just because you don't get a conviction doesn't mean it wasn't worth going through the process. And that, you know, maybe there's a benefit that the city has looked more about the need for police reforms. And so it shouldn't all be dismissed as a bad news story. But I think that different people are going to react to this differently. And some that never saw a reason for these charges to be brought are not going to change their minds.
I see. Well, on that point, let's listen to some tape from Marilyn Mosby herself, because she did talk, as you pointed out, about changes that have been made to prevent deaths such as Freddie Gray's. So let's listen.
Never again should there be a question as to why someone is being stopped, detained, or arrested due to the fact that there will now soon be full implementation of body-worn cameras on all officers.
That's right.
That's right. Never again should someone be placed unsecured and defenseless in a metal wagon head first, feet shackled and handcuffed. Come on.
So Jennifer, that's right. Yes, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
So she is pointing to the fact that the Baltimore Police Department officers are now going to wear body cameras. They're now having new vans with cameras in them. They're also reviewing the police officers and maybe we'll see if they are internally disciplined for failing to put seatbelts on Freddie Gray. But I can just point out at the same time, the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union, is actually suing the city of Baltimore to get rid of an outside civilian review board. So this is a big fight. We have calls for police reform, and we'll have to see what actually comes of that.
Yeah, so much going on. Of course, we remember back in September, the city of Baltimore reached a settlement with Freddie Gray's family for $6 million as well.
Right. So, yeah. Some amount of justice, some people say, has been had.
That's NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now. So what more did we learn about Hillary Clinton from her husband Bill's historic speech last night? We'll hear something about when the Clintons moved daughter Chelsea into college.
I'll never forget moving her into her dorm room at Stanford. It would have been a great little reality flick. There I was in a trance, just staring out the window, trying not to cry. And there was Hillary on her hands and knees, desperately looking for one more drawer to put that liner paper in.
Okay, went over with the crowd, but was it, as New York Times columnist Maureen O'Dowd wrote, trying to feminize and maternalize Hillary Clinton just a little bit too much? Let's bring in Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico. He's been covering Hillary Clinton for years. Your thoughts on Maureen Dowd's take?
It was a little harsh. I mean, look, here's the problem that Bill Clinton has in talking about Hillary. These are oft-told, oft-fact-checked tales. And there are large swaths of their joint biography that are not suitable for family hour television, as they say. So the problem here is these are really charming stories. They worked inside the hall. They probably did no damage. But it points out to just how awkward a surrogate Bill Clinton is for his wife.
You think so?
I do. I mean, and this was something I really observed in Iowa. Bill Clinton, the line between Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton has always been permeable. But it is often very difficult when he's out on the trail to tell when he's advocating for himself, sort of flacking for his own legacy and pushing for her. I remember being in an Iowa firehouse, and for 2 hours he made the case for Hillary Clinton by showing a series of color copies of economic growth under his administration.
Well, but in this case he was talking about liner paper, and that has a certain signal to a lot of people. Wow, liner paper. I never had time to put liner paper in. So it has that signal. But let's back up and do just a little bit of biography here. We've talked about how her mother, Dorothy, how she grew up with a, Hillary did with a Dickensian childhood of poverty. No, her mother did with a Dickensian childhood of poverty, neglect, child labor. Her father, Hugh Rodham, a very strict conservative and Republican. Talk a little bit about how she was formed.
Well, I mean, Dorothy Rodham is the person that had the greatest influence on Hillary Clinton. She was a progressive. She had this hardscrabble childhood. But I always find these references to Hugh Rodham, the father, to be really interesting. Carl Bernstein wrote a very good book right before the 2008 campaign talking about just how tough a dad he was. A lot of people think Hugh Rodham's being a difficult dad, borderline, some people would think abusive, really shaped her and really put her in this shell that she has so much difficulty breaking out of.
Yeah, well, talk about that. This feeling, people who know her, and there are many, we've said before, how does she keep up with these many relationships that we're seeing paraded here? Say you've never met someone more warm and personal. I've had a chance to meet her. You've spoken with her one-on-one.
Yeah.
Why? What is that icy reserve? Is that dad? What is that?
I don't know exactly what it is, but as you said, you know, I had her on for 50 minutes for a podcast a couple of months ago, and she can be really enormously charming, and I've covered her over the years, same thing. Look, in 1992, the most interesting thing she said, the most resonant thing she said during that campaign is, "I demand a zone of privacy." Think about how preposterous that is in the context of presidential politics in 2016. She really does believe that there is a separation. You know, the Clintons are always talk. People always talk about compartmentalization with the Clintons. This is the demonstration of that.
Well, and I can hear people saying, well, wait a second, would you ask if a man who was running for office had an icy reserve? But well, you would, because for a politician, that's the whole game. You have to, people have to, what is it? They want to have a drink with you.
Well, isn't that the irony, right? The one candidate who benefited from that line, the person you really wanted to have a drink with, was George W. Bush, who's been sober for his entire adult life, right? So this is a combination of sort of authenticity and artifice. And the way that I describe Hillary Clinton is, I do think she's an authentic person, but she has difficulty projecting that. She's not good at the artifice part.
And what about how, if she is president, she might be welcomed back into Washington? We know the battle over her version of health care.
Yeah, I mean, look, she is, it's a paradox. In 1993 and 1994, she really blew up the Clinton administration with this very secretive health care plan. But I covered her in the early 2000s when she was working the Hill in the Senate. And I, you know, as much as she talks about her Secretary of State tenure, the Senate tenure, I think, was her crowning achievement. She really learned how to work across the aisle. And I think if she gets elected president, you're going to be very surprised by the warmth of the relationship she has with Republicans on Capitol Hill.
And talk about that, because you know, people were saying when she was pushing for the health care bill that she'd drawn up, I mean, she would say things like, I'm going to get you if you don't pass this. But now she's known as this person who's a negotiator. She's been a diplomat. And that's what's turned off part of the party who don't want compromise.
Look, there have been so many iterations of Hillary Clinton. This is one of the great problems that she had, and it's one of the great problems when Bill Clinton is laying out her biography. You can talk about her achievements, you can talk about her warmth, you can talk about her history. The problem is, this is a change election with an angry electorate, an itchy electorate, and just talking about her 30 years reminds people of how long she's actually been on the public stage.
Yeah, Glenn, we've got about a minute here. What would you want people to know about Hillary Clinton that we haven't mentioned that they might not know at this point?
I think the thing about Hillary Clinton that you know, is that she has a nasty, zinging, and I mean that in a positive way because I'm from Brooklyn, sense of humor. And the other thing I think people don't realize is, as bitter as Bernie Sanders was about losing and how difficult it was for him to adjust to that fact, there was some bitterness in Hillary Clinton in terms of the way that Sanders treated her.
Yeah. And what do we take from, what does that mean going forward?
Well, I think we have seen a calming of the waters, but it will be interesting if she can hold the line and remain as positive towards him as she has been this week.
Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico. Thanks so much.
Great.
Well, earlier today we ran into someone who's been very hard to miss and probably spent some time in this center where basketball greats play. It was basketball legend turned political activist and writer Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He's written about the recent terrible spasms of violence against young black men and against police. We met inside the Wells Fargo Center as the band was testing the sound system. Thinking of some of your recent writing, I want to talk to you about the current climate in America. Mm-hmm. You had this great line where you described some of these spasms of violence as if Quentin Tarantino made Groundhog Day, and as if we were getting up and seeing these same events day after day. What would you want to hear from the Democrats to change that?
Well, I'm just hoping that what we're all observing has to do with the fact that the educational system and the lack of jobs really have created a climate where everybody is pretty frightened. It just takes some leadership to figure these things out and have a national agenda that will address these issues.
Well, what about race relations, though? How much, you know, again, we're talking about these spasms of violence. You're the grandson, I think, also, of law enforcement officers.
Yes.
So what's your take on race relations and police-community relations?
Well, I think that we have to acknowledge that racism is institutionalized in our criminal justice system, and we have to do what we can to ameliorate that. White Americans can count on doing better, having better results everywhere from birth rates, the prison pipeline. People of color have a harder time getting mortgage money. All of these things compound to make lives very difficult and to make it impossible for people to keep pace.
But, so you also say that there are two heroes in the current narrative, and one of them is conscientious cops.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the cops, we ask so much of them. We ask too much of them. They have to go out and just do a whole lot of jobs that the rest of society does not want to deal with. The whole idea that mental health is such an expensive issue, we're not going to deal with it. And so when mentally ill people finally go over the edge, the cops are there to... And it drops in their lap, and they got to take these people to prison, and then these people finally get the help that they've been needing. That shouldn't be their job.
You say the other part of the hero equation, though, is members of the Black Lives Matter movement. And you know, sadly, we saw in Dallas, they were actually working together, the cops and the Black Lives Matter movement, right before that incident.
Then they had this cowardly attack on the Dallas police force.
It could be a sick attack. It could be the mental illness you were talking about. Or it could be what some Black Lives Matter leaders have said, you know, a combination of mental illness and someone who is Black who has endured some of the things you were just talking about, some of the inequities you just talked about. Do you worry about that combination? Oh, there's the band warming up. Do you worry about that combination?
Well, that always is an issue. You know, the fact that people see the disparity in the way that they're being treated, and they know they're being discriminated against, and they want to lash out against it. It's only natural. So, and it ends up in some of these unfortunate incidents. We have to try to eliminate that kind of thing.
We also told Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that we thought he might have a unique perspective, not just because of his height, and he said he did. He's fawned over as a celebrity, but he says people also can be jealous of a Black man who's successful. He feels that racism. And of course, young Blacks feel that as well, seen one way and then often another way while, say, driving a car. So how do Blacks and whites bridge that?
Well, I think it's all about being honest, you know, and being able to talk to your fellow citizens like their values, like their opinion is valuable, and the way that they're supposed to be respected will be upheld.
Thank you so much, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and choir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think the only time he's ever been overpowered in a basketball arena is possibly by a choir. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar here at the DNC. He, by the way, has a new book out. It's called Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White. And we'll link you to some of his writings at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Dolly the sheep, the first successfully cloned mammal, would have turned 20 years old this month. However, she had to be euthanized in 2003 after contracting a lung virus. But in a sense, Dolly lives because there's Daisy, Debbie, Denise, and Diana, some of the 13 sister clones from the same group of cells that Dolly came from. And it seems they're doing well. Joining us now with details is Sharon Begley. She's a senior science writer for STAT, our weekly partners on health and medicine. Sharon, good to have you back.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, I mentioned that Dolly had to get euthanized in 2003 after contracting a lung virus, but she actually had some other health problems before they euthanized her. Remind us of that.
Right. So she was 6 years old when she was euthanized. But a year earlier, when she was only five, she developed arthritis in her knees. And when that happened, sheep age is about 8 years human age. So age 40 in human terms is what she would have been then, which is kind of young to develop arthritis. So there was a concern that something about the cloning process had accelerated aging. And that's what these scientists were trying to figure out in their new study.
Okay. So tell us about what they discovered then with these other cloned sheep. And also, just to be clear, they weren't born at the same time Dolly was, but they're from the same group of cells.
That's right. This is the same batch of cells, literally the same collection of cells that were taken from the female adult sheep that created Dolly 20 years ago. And the researchers in Scotland were using the cells to see if they could improve the efficiency of the cloning process. As it is now, you know, you transfer the DNA into the donor, into the recipient egg, and that only works in terms of a live of pregnancy and a live birth fewer than 1% of the time. So that was the study that was going on more than 10 years ago. These Dolly sisters are now between 7 and 9 years old. So the idea was, so they were created a little less than a decade ago, and see as they grew older, did they develop not only arthritis, but also heart disease and type 2 diabetes, both of which are also diseases of aging. And the short answer, the bottom line is, these four clones show no evidence of accelerated aging.
Huh. Now, if I remember correctly, Dolly also had some shortening of her chromosomes, of telomeres, is that right? I mean, and that was raising concerns. Did they find something similar in these other sheep?
Right. So telomeres are the ends of chromosomes, and they have been associated, or they're thought to be markers of aging. When telomeres get shorter, we are getting older, and we are biologically older. So these scientists from the University of Nottingham did not do those molecular tests. They did not assess the length of the telomeres in the chromosomes of these four sheep, nor did they do another test that might have looked at whether something about the cloning process messes up the DNA, and that's called looking for epigenetic markers. So it could still be that these four cloned sheep have a sort of on a genetic or a molecular time bomb inside them that has not gone off yet. And again, using the 8 human years to 1 sheep year metric, these animals are now the equivalent of 56 to 72 human years. So it hasn't gone off yet, but that doesn't mean it won't eventually. But we can say that they've reached well into middle age and even early old age with no sign of aging prematurely.
So steps forward, but still a lot of unanswered questions. The science continues. That's Sharon Begley, senior science writer for STAT, our weekly partners in health and medicine. Sharon, thanks.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's Here and Now.
In Philadelphia, it's Here and Now.
Hillary and I share a few things in common. We both went to Wellesley College, so I know where she got her study habits.
And that's another former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, last night at the DNC. You heard the cheers. Could have been Wellesley alums. There are many in town. And Hillary Clinton cites Wellesley as a major influence. She stayed connected to the college. Many of her fellow alums feel similarly connected to Wellesley and to her. We met up with some of them earlier this week at a Wellesley Alumni Club of Philadelphia DNC party.
Fill in over here on the right. On three, say Wellesley. One, two, three.
Wellesley!
You got quite a party going here. That's Erin Bloom Slattery. She helped organize this event and also helps recruit students to go to Wellesley.
And how much of a draw is one particular graduate that you have?
I think this is really exciting for all of us. We're all celebrating. And
you said you graduated '99. So when you were going to school, I mean, this was post the Bill Clinton era. This was, you know, you already knew who Hillary was.
I knew who Hillary was, yeah.
How much did that mean to you?
It was very important. It was a pretty critical part of why I went to Wellesley. I think I was part of the Hillary effect at Wellesley. I was going into Wellesley in 1995. And there's no doubt that she had a big influence on lots of young women across the country applying to Wellesley. And
well, I'm going to ask a tender question, though. That's also, it was an administration that also just ended in scandal and accusations and unseemly behavior towards a young intern, a college intern, you know, Monica Lewinsky. That didn't throw you off?
I think as a young woman at Wellesley, I learned how to stand up for myself and to have a voice and feel empowered. And it certainly influenced how I looked at the world, but it was also a time of great prosperity in the United States. So I, as a young person going out into the world, I really wanted to make my own way and was very confident in, that I would be able to do that and have a really strong economy that allowed me to do that.
Well, I'm wondering, okay, so I mentioned the Bill Clinton scandal. A lot of people were critical of Hillary Clinton for standing by him. And also some felt that she disparaged other women who had made accusations against him, that she threw some women under the bus. I'm wondering, though, if also the fact that she survived that whole time was inspirational to you.
I think it is. I think overall, like, her legacy as a strong woman over the her entire career is more of an inspiration to me than anything her husband may have done.
And what do you think about this week? Talk about the battles that she had to fight to get here.
I think every single day this week, hearing what's happening, celebrating her successes, just reiterates to us how important it is for women getting out there and really trying to make a difference in the world. And she has really illuminated many of the issues of sexism that women face every single day. And as someone who's been in the workforce for about 17 years, I face sexism. I think a lot of young people will say, maybe we don't face these issues anymore, but we do. They're real, and we need to keep speaking up for ourselves and realizing that women do have a place in society and can make a mark in our jobs and our lives.
Hi, how are you?
That's Donna Marshall, class of 1984. She's here for two reasons, for the Wellesley reunion and...
And, of course, to support Hillary. Of course.
You say of course. Tell me more about the of course.
Well, not just the fact that she's a Wellesley graduate. Of course, I would support anyone who's a Wellesley graduate, but she's bright, she's intelligent, she has experience, and I'm backing her 100%.
Well, my name is Margot Label, and I'm a Wellesley graduate, and yes, I will vote for Hillary.
What do you say to people? We can see the Wellesley pride here, but girls' school...
Women's college.
Women's college. But has a whiff for people in some parts of the country of being a little bit maybe elitist, a little bit removed, insular, because it's a women's college. What do you say to that? That Hillary Clinton has to win over people in parts of the country who aren't feeling like they could ever consider going to Wellesley College. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. And I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Yeah, and my mother is from my family is all from the Midwest.
Hillary is from Scranton.
Yeah, and I went to Wellesley, and it's open to all folks from all over the country, all over the world. I don't think elitist. I don't think so. I think it's about the education you get. It's about being a woman and celebrating that fact. It's not elitist and being in some, like, ivory tower. Not at all. It's all about the intellectual experience.
Hey, you have a name tag on. Did you go to Wellesley?
No, I'm actually a daughter of an alum, and I'll be starting Smith in a couple weeks.
Fantastic. What's your name?
My name's Fiona.
And Mom, come on over here. What year?
87.
And what's your name?
Ann Fox.
So what does it mean to you that Hillary Clinton went to a sister school?
It means that she understands what being a woman leader means. Other than being a woman and a leader, it means looking out for your fellow women who are trying to rise up, and it means knowing what kind of hardships there are for women in the workplace and women of color in the workplace specifically. And I feel that means she has a very good grip on what needs to be done and the types of institutional sexism and racism that she needs to tackle.
How old are you?
I'm 17.
Mom, obviously a fan and obviously a source of great pride, but also the Clintons were involved in one of the most scandalous chapters in American history. And, you know, there are some women who, I've said this before to some of the Wellesley women here, some women who felt that Hillary had actually let women down in that phase, that she should have gotten up and announced, he's sleeping in the doghouse, and we should never be treating an intern that way. Did that not shake your faith?
Oh, not even a little bit. I mean,
it's not fair. It's her marriage. Like, I feel like we have no position speaking about this. I mean, yes, it would have been nice if she had stuck up for the intern, but the intern was a consenting adult. And I think it's really rotten that women are judging her, because if she had divorced to Bill Clinton or made a large statement, then women would be criticizing her for not standing by her man. Like, I don't think she could have won, and I think it's their private marriage, and I don't like that people are judging.
I just don't think that I'd even come close to characterizing that as one of the most scandalous times in American history. I mean, what I'm seeing right now from the Republicans is so far beyond the pale of what happened between those two people and their marriage, that I just don't even find it even remotely important to talk about. And they worked it out.
Nearby, a group of four friends, including Monique Burnett.
We all just had a discussion about, would we expect Republican women from the area who are Wellesley alumni to come to this event? And I think we're actually a little disappointed more didn't come. And we all said, if it were the other way around and this were a Republican convention, I think most of us said we would come just for support, because that's really what the Wellesley experience embodied for us, is the sisterhood, support, and service. Correct?
Well, are there some here? Are there any Republican women here? Maybe you were, I don't know.
Former Republican.
Oh, you're former Republican?
Yes.
And when did that change? You are.
When Barack Obama ran for president of the United States. And the United States, you know, House and Senate didn't do their jobs, and they're still not doing their jobs. And, you know, it would be great if they could go back to being functional. But until that time, right now, Hillary's the only one qualified. She's eminently qualified, and that's where I'm going to put my support.
And yet for decades, it sounds like, and you are Karen Mazur-Larsen, 1982, so it sounds like for a great deal of time, even while the Clintons were in office, despite the fact that you were a Wellesley grad, you were not for Hillary. The fact that she went to Wellesley and was a woman, that didn't change your party affiliation when she was married to Bill Clinton.
No. This is not a woman's election. This is about who's most qualified to govern the country. And the person who's most qualified to do that with a sense of hope and justice. I mean, Donald Trump has not done that. He's a misogynist, he's racist, and he's not qualified. And Hillary is none of those things. She's eminently qualified, and she provides hope.
So a newly minted, at least in the last few years, Republican Wellesley.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm now a newly minted Democrat. For the time being, it's about who's most qualified. It's not about, in this case, party loyalty. It's about who is most capable of governing. It's too important.
Just a few of the Wellesley alum, and in one case, a daughter, at the Wellesley Alumni Club of Philadelphia DNC party at Independence Beer Hall yesterday. It's Here and Now.
John Hinckley Jr. has won his freedom. He'll be released from a government psychiatric hospital more than 35 years after he attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan. Hinckley had been obsessed with the actress Jodie Foster when he shot Reagan and three others in order to impress her. Hinckley's lawyers tell NPR that he is, quote, profoundly sad and sorry for the pain he caused his victims, and he will be required to live full-time with his elderly mother upon his release. But the Reagan Presidential Foundation says it believes he's still a threat to others and opposes the decision made today by U.S. District Judge Paul Friedman. Eddie Dean has written extensively about Hinckley for Washingtonian Magazine. And Eddie, I mean, Hinckley's getting released, but he's already been spending a lot of time away from the psychiatric hospital, hasn't he?
Yeah, for the last few years, he spent about half the year going to his mom's house in Kingsmill, which is outside of Williamsburg, Virginia. It's about 2 hours south of St. Elizabeth's, where he spends the rest of his time. And he's been there since he shot Reagan. So he's basically a patient there, but this conditional release situation has let him try to sort of, quote, start a new life living with his mom. He's 61, basically lives like a teenager. He tries to record music, goes to music stores, eats junk food.
Well, I've also seen that, you know, over time, as he's been allowed more time outside of St. E's, as you said, that there have been some times where he hasn't actually complied with what's been expected. Like, for example, one time when he went to a bookstore and was looking at books about Ronald Reagan. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, what it is he's on a very strict itinerary. So when he goes down to see his mom, he's supposed to do certain things, go to certain places. So this one day that you're referring to, he was supposed to be seeing a movie, and at the same little shopping mall, he went to a Barnes & Noble bookstore. You got to understand, he's being surveilled by the FBI, and they watch him go into this Barnes & Noble. And for a long time, he just stood at this one row of books on presidential assassinations and just stared. And it really disturbed the Secret Service agent, who said it gave him goosebumps because Hinckley would stare at the books but not reach out and touch a book or pick it up and leaf through it like you'd think. He just was fixated on this particular row of books.
Yeah,
he's looking for his own place in history still. That's what the psychiatrist said.
Well, yeah, because I was just about to ask, you know, the times where he has deviated from the itinerary, the people treating John Hinckley didn't necessarily see it as a setback to his treatment.
Yeah, some of the mental health evaluators there, especially at St. E's, think it shows that he's trying to live independently. Another incident that happened was when he was supposed to go with a photographer. He's taken lessons from a photographer. It's kind of a new hobby that Hinckley has now. He's picked up a Nikon and he's going around taking photos, which disturbed some people in Kingsmill. The original thing he did with Jodie Foster is basically stalking. So here's the most infamous stalker in the world now with a sort of high-powered camera wandering around. In the meantime, he's supposed to go to the photographer to get his lesson, and he deviates from the itinerary and goes to a music studio that's down in Williamsburg. And he just hung out for a while, and he wanted to know how much it would cost to record a song.
Well, the terms of his release include not being allowed to contact any of his victims, their relatives, or Jodie Foster.
Right.
He's also not going to be permitted to travel to areas where the current president or any members of Congress are present. But I'm curious. I mean, he's being released to his mother. She's 90, right? And so what happens when she passes away?
Well, getting back to the first part of that, there's tons of red flags that the prosecutors have brought up repeatedly. Like, they live on the 13th hole of a golf course in Kingsmill. Many times, Bill Clinton has come by and played golf. Obama has played golf on that course. It's where they have an LPGA tournament. So for a lot of people, particularly the prosecutors, there's some red flags there. Now, with his mom being 90, she's actually in pretty good health. So they think that they have enough money to pay for the mental health team in Waynesburg for 5 years. So if her health holds up, he could be there for a while.
Yeah. You know, this case, the attempted assassination of President Reagan and the trial that followed, I mean, it was really an important moment for the United States for so many reasons. One of them is which he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, right?
Yeah.
And after that, the bar got raised pretty substantially for using the insanity defense after that, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, it caused a big hubbub when, you know, that verdict came down, and a lot of people still don't like that verdict. So now what they're saying is he's healthy mentally, or at least he's not psychotic. He actually suffers from narcissistic personality disorder, but they say he's not a danger to himself or others. So that's the key thing as to why this judge is ordering his release. Hinckley's legal team has spent like the last 20 years proving he's not a threat. And so far in Waynesburg, the main thing he's done is go look up on books on the presidential assassinations, try to go make a record on his own. And basically, he brought a feral cat down that ran away. So he's not been violent. Now, the problem is he going to be able to do this full time? Because without the itineraries, the prosecutors are thinking he could just go off the handle.
Well, Eddie Dean is a contributing editor for Washingtonian Magazine. He's written extensively about John Hinckley Jr. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we've got links to Eddie's reporting on John Hinckley at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.